Chris in Tennessee, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Revere Radio Network, the worldwide home of free speech. My name is Chris. This show is called Nowhere to Run. You can visit Nowhere to Run's website at nowheretorun.podomatic.com. And there you will find all the archives for the previous shows free of charge. You can also access the show notes and different things like that. You can do the same thing at some of the other podcasting sites around the internet, as well as iTunes. You can also go to Revere Radio site, which is revereradio.net, and that will be beneficial to you also because you can access Revere Radio's free 24-hour hours-a-day stream where they stream original programming of shows very much like this one and other conspiracy-related material. Revere Radio kind of has the reputation of being the renegades or the bad boys of Internet talk radio. And the other guys live up to that a little bit more than I do. I guess I'm a renegade in a few ways as well, but definitely worth checking out. Also, we have a new way to contact me. You can always contact me and send me your hate mail and so on at chris@conspiracyclothes.com. That's chris@conspiracyclothes.com. But you can now also write me via snail mail. I have a big old P.O. box that you can write to me at, and that is P.O. Box 1437, Gallatin, Tennessee, G-A-L-L-A-T-I-N, Tennessee, 37066. And I'll try to give that address out for you guys. If you don't like sending the emails or you want to contact me or whatever, you can do it in that way. I've got a really good show for you today. That you're not going to want to miss a minute of. It is another two-hour show, so there's a lot of information. I'm going to play three important clips on varying topics, so we're going to hit a lot of different types of things. But it is a clip show, and I guess in that way a cop-out. And so I think it would be appropriate for me to play a little short clip regarding clip shows, thanks to our friends The Simpsons. Don't worry, this probably won't make any sense to most of you unless you are a Simpsons geek, but it's just appropriate for the occasion. So here we go.
Home and George, Christmas show, Marge is King, Homer's bro, Farting Well, Flanders fails, Quacking Snakes, Monorail, Mr. Plow, Homer's face, Sideshow Bob, steps on rakes, Lisa's future, Selma's hobby, Marge not proud, Homer chubby, Homer worries, Bart is gay, Bucci, you two, NRA, Hippies, Vegas, and Japan, Octuplets, and Barge Boy Band, Marge murmurs, Maud croaks, Lisa Buddhas, Homer tokes, Maggie blows, burns away, what else do I have to say?
They'll never stop the Simpsons. Have no fears, we've got stories for years, like Marge becomes a robot, Kevin Logan's a cell phone, has Bart ever owned a bear, or how about a crazy wedding, where something happens, and do-do-do-do-do, sorry for the clip show, have no fears, we've got stories for years.
Okay, the first clip that I want to play is I want to introduce you to somebody. Some of the listeners probably have heard of him. Some of you haven't. His name is George Gordon. He does a radio show on a few different things. He's kind of an independent operation as far as much as I can gather, but I know that he's on some other internet talk radio stations. But his name is George Gordon. You can visit his website at georgegordon.org, where he's got an extensive amount of material available to download for free. He is a very interesting guy. I could just listen to him. He's one of the few like talk show hosts I could just listen to and listen to and listen to. He's very informative, and he really provides a really, really good service just by him just jabbering about stuff. And so anyway, I'm going to play this clip from him, and it's kind of one of the topics he tends to hit right off the top, so I think it was appropriate. It's about somewhere around 20 minutes long. And it is a very interesting clip. So let me play that for you, and I'll see you on the other side.
Are you a practicing communist? I did a series of lectures in Salt Lake City, Utah, many years ago. And I had an audience of about 200 people, and I asked that question. And I had been invited there by the local Ford dealer, whose business was down on South State Street. And we were meeting in a hall on South State Street, or in a meeting place. I think it was a Holiday Inn or a Ramada or something like that. Maybe it was the American Inn. My host, the guy that had put this meeting together and invited all the people there, the local Ford dealer, a local Mormon fellow, he was sitting in the front row. And he was there with his wife, and he must have had about 5, 6, 8 kids, I don't know. They lined up, and they took the whole front center section right up in the front of the meeting room. And I asked that question, are you a practicing communist? And I looked around the room, and I said, how many of you out there are practicing communists? Let me see your hands, you know. So I raised my hand, and I looked all over, you know, and 4 or 5 people in the audience, you know, raised their hands. And, of course, my host, the Ford dealer, he didn't raise his hand. And he certainly wasn't a practicing communist. And so I said, well, thank you very much. I'm really impressed with you people here in the land of Mormons that there are so few practicing communists. Because all over America, there are practicing communists, fifth columnists, who are in our midst claiming that they are anti-communists, but in reality they actually can be known by their fruits. So I said, for instance, the first plank to the Communist Manifesto calls for the abolition of property and land and the application of all rent of land to public purposes. And I said, here in America, we practice this as an example here in the West. The federal government claims to own much of this land out here in the West. And if you want to use this land, you have to go to the BLM or to the Department of Agriculture or to the Forest Service or somebody and sign a contract with them and pay them rent to put your cattle out there or to mine on that land. Now, there was a time when we had private property in this country, in which you own the property. But today, we have to pay a property tax on that property. We don't have a low-deal tenure and title. And if you don't pay your property tax on your home, your business, or your farm, or your land, then it will be taken from you and sold on the courthouse steps to somebody else who will pay that tax, who will pay that rent. So if you take a look at all of the land in America, and then you compare it to the first plank to the Communist Manifesto, which calls for the abolition of property and land, you don't own any land. You are renting it from the state, and you pay a tax. You pay a rent on it. And if you don't pay the rent, then you're going to lose that property. And I turned to the audience, and I said, how many of you pay a property tax? And about half the people in the audience raised their hands. Again, the Ford dealer didn't raise his hand. I went on to the second plank, and I said, the second plank to the Communist Manifesto calls for a heavy progressive or graduated income tax. I said, there are many Americans who pay this heavy progressive or graduated income tax here in America. And I pointed out to my audience that there was a time in America when we didn't pay this heavy progressive income tax, that Americans were free from this tax. Again, I asked the audience, how many of you here in the audience pay a heavy progressive income tax? Nearly everybody in the audience raised their hands, except the Ford dealer sitting in the front row. The third plank, I said to my audience, I said, calls for the abolition of all right of inheritance. And I said, here in America, the inheritance tax just represents approximately 1/3 of the estate. And I said, most of us go out and get a marriage license, and we create a three-party limited general partnership between the boy, the girl, and the state. Time goes on, and the boy and girl working together, they accumulate some wealth. Usually houses and cars and snow machines and farms and cattle and things like that. And then one day old Bill dies. And Martha says, oh good, Bill died. Now I get all of the toys. And then I pointed out, until we come to the inheritance tax in which the state, the third party in the game, comes forward and says, wait, Martha. We have a marriage agreement here, and we have an inheritance tax. And the inheritance tax is just one third. It runs 28-35% across the country. And we want you, Martha, to buy me out. So I suggested to the audience, how many of you here have a marriage license with your spouse in a three-party limited general partnership, and do you have an inheritance tax here in Utah? And again, nearly everybody in the audience raised their hands. Yes, they did in fact have a marriage license, and yes, we do indeed have an inheritance tax here in Utah. I noticed that my host, the Ford dealer, did not raise his hand. The fourth plank, I pointed out, calls for the confiscation of the property of all immigrants and rebels. And I pointed out that there is a process going on called regional government with absolute federal control over all property, public and private. And that this confiscation of the property of all immigrants and rebels was a part and parcel with the IRS program of seizing and distraining people's property and selling it if they don't pay their income tax or social security taxes and so on. And I said, do you have any kinds of, or more than one, or any government agents or agencies who might seize your property, confiscate your property through distraint if you didn't pay these taxes? And everybody in the audience raised their hands and said, oh yeah, yeah, we have an IRS, we have a state tax commission. Yeah, we have OSHA and the EPA. We have a whole host and plethora of government agencies that have the power to take our businesses, our homes, our property, seize our bank accounts. Yes, nearly everybody raised their hands. Everybody except the Ford dealer, my host, sitting in the front row. I went on to the fifth commandment. Oh, excuse me. I meant the fifth plank. I keep forgetting. You know, we Americans used to practice the Ten Commandments here in the United States. Now, the Ten Commandments are the exact opposite to the Ten Planks to the Communist Manifesto. You see, the Ten Commandments have a commandment that says, thou shalt not steal. Thou shalt not steal is the basis. It is the foundation of property rights. If you want to own property, you have to have a law that says, thou shalt not steal. I've often wondered if that's why we took the Ten Commandments out of our public schools. Well, anyway, I went on to the fifth plank to the Communist Manifesto, and I pointed out, it calls for the centralization of credit in the hands of the state by means of a national bank with state capital and an exclusive monopoly. So I looked up and I turned to the audience and I said, now, do you have a Federal Reserve Bank here in Salt Lake City? Do you have any Federal Reserve notes circulating in your stores and businesses? Do you have a central bank that you people here in Utah use to clear checks, use credit cards, and other unjust weights and balances that are prohibited in the scripture? Again, nearly everybody in the audience raised their hands and said, oh yeah, we've got this central bank called the Federal Reserve here. I said, did you know that every country in the world has a central bank? Did you know there's a central bank in England, France, Germany, Russia, China? Did you know that? Cuba? And everybody is sitting now, you know, wide awake, wide-eyed, paying attention. And it was right here with the centralization of credit in the hands of the state by means of a national bank with state capital and an exclusive monopoly, that the Ford dealer stood up with his wife and motioned to his children, and they walked out of the meeting hall. You see, boys and girls, in the first five planks to the Communist Manifesto, if I were to ask you, are you a practicing communist? We're not quite through with the 10 planks, but the first five, nearly everybody in America is practicing. Are they not? Aren't you? Now, I might point out that in 1900, just 100 years ago or so, none of these 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto were in full force in effect. Oh, it's true. We had an income tax clear back to the Civil War days. In fact, I can trace you back a little bit further than that if we do a little historical research. In fact, the first income tax that was created here in the United States was created in 1778 in New York State. That's right. New York State enacted an income tax in 1778. By 1825, 25% of the states in the Union had an income tax. The income tax, boys and girls, goes back to ancient Babylon, Assyria, Greece, Rome, and Egypt. It is ancient. It's been around forever. If you thought that Karl Marx was sitting around, you know, in his stupor, funk up the income tax, the second and fifth planks to the Communist Manifesto. Oh, no. No, it's been around for a long time. It's a religious practice. In fact, communism is a religion. It's a religion. Atheism is a religion. It's a belief in no God. That's all. Some people believe in Allah, and some people believe in Jesus, and some people believe in Buddha, and some people believe in no God at all. They're all religious ideologies. They're philosophies. Everybody's religious. Karl Marx was religious. Nikolai Lenin, Joe Stalin, George Bush. They're all religious. They have different religions and they worship different gods. They have different philosophies and ideologies, but they're all traceable back to a common origin way, way back into the distant past. Well, now that my host had now abandoned me and left the auditorium, left the meeting room with his family, because by the time we had finished the fifth plank to the Communist Manifesto, I think that it had dawned on him that he was a practicing communist, and it was more than he could philosophically take. Because, you see, we Americans since the end of World War II have been radical, vehement anti-communists. We have always seen ourselves as the good guys in white hats, and the communists are the bad guys in black hats. And we're the defenders of freedom and democracy around the world. And the communists represent the exact opposite to that. They represent tyranny. They represent everything that we loathe and despise. Surely we Americans could not be practicing that which we loathe and despise. Well, let's go on. The sixth plank calls for the centralization of the means of communication and transport in the hands of the state. And I pointed out to my audience that in this country we call that the Federal Communications Commission. And that you can't transmit over the airwaves your beliefs, your ideas, your philosophies. You have to get a license from the federal government, and they regulate what you can say over the air. As you listen to me right now over the airwaves, there are limitations on my right to free speech. I cannot tell you, I cannot say to you certain things that are prohibited by federal or state government. And there are certain things I have to tell you, mandated by law. They say, well, you've got to tell these people this, and you cannot tell these people that. So I just wanted you to know that even though you've got a First Amendment right to free speech and a First Amendment right to freedom of religion, you can't necessarily practice 100% of. Now, there is free speech in communist China. And there's free speech in Russia. There's free speech in totalitarian regimes all around the world. And then there are limitations on free speech in every country, including the United States, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand, and the democracies of Western Europe. For instance, we have prohibitions against hate speech. Did you know in Canada, if you were to say in Canada, I don't believe in the Holocaust, I don't believe that 6 million Jews were killed in Hitler's gas chambers and ovens. Do you know that's a crime? That's a crime in Germany. You're called a Holocaust denier. Well, at least in those two countries, Canada and Germany. I can't speak for anybody else. But now that's not free speech. It may well be that it is a preposterous lie. But the people who have enacted that kind of legislation don't believe in free speech. And neither do communists, and neither does the Communist Manifesto tolerate free speech. Now, if you wanted to say, I believe in the Holocaust, and I believe Hitler is really a no-good, dirty down-and-outer, and he got his just rewards. Now, that's the kind of free speech that you can say in Canada and Germany. Oh, that's fine free speech, whether you believe it or not. You can say that. So I just wanted to point out to you that the sixth plank is alive and well in the United States of America. Now, the seventh plank calls for the extension of factories and instruments of production owned by the state and the bringing into cultivation of wastelands and the improvement of the soil generally in accordance with a common plan. I looked over the audience and I said, how many of you out here practice the seventh plank? Nobody raised their hands. They all looked at one another like, huh? What does that mean? Okay, so I'm not sure that you understood what the seventh plank is telling you, so let me translate that into modern English. The extension of factories and instruments of production owned by the state are called corporations, limited liability companies, artificial entities. Do you have any of those here in Utah? Oh, yes, everybody started nodding their head and raised their hands. Yes, yes, we have corporations. Limited liability companies, we have artificial entities here. I said, okay. And then the bringing into cultivation of wastelands in Idaho is called the Desert Land Entry Act. Do you have any government programs here for regulation and control of the public lands? No. Oh, yes, yes, we have that here in Utah. So, okay, that's two. And then finally, I said, do you have anything in your call code that deals with the improvement of the soil generally in accordance with a common plan, such as soil conservation districts? Oh, yes, yes, we have that here in Utah. I said, okay, well, then I guess everybody here is in agreement that we all practice the seventh plank to the Communist Manifesto, at least here in Utah. And everybody agreed, and I said, well, let me assure you that they do the same thing in Georgia, Florida, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey as well. So you're in good company. Went on to the eighth plank, and I said, it calls for the equal liability of all to labor and the establishment of industrial armies, especially for agriculture. I said, translated, that means, do you have a social security number? Equal liability of all to labor and the establishment of industrial armies. Social security has enjoined Americans into a gigantic industrial army. We're all members of the same group. You cannot work without it. Everybody was in agreement. Yes, yes, we all have social security numbers. I said, I'm going to skip the ninth plank, and I want to go to the tenth plank, and I'll come back to the ninth because it takes a little more time to explain. So I skipped over to the 10th plank, and I said, it calls for free education for all children in public schools and the abolition of children's factory labor in its present form and combination of education with industrial production. I said, do you have public schools here in Utah? Everybody raised their hands. Yeah, yeah, we all have. Do you send your children to these public schools? Well, a few people didn't raise their hands because they do have some private schools, and quite a few Mormons homeschool. Mormons have never been very happy with the public school system. And so to their credit, many, many Mormons have jerked their kids out of the public schools and they educate them privately at home or they send them to a parochial school. But most, you know, probably 75% of the people in the room raised their hand and said, yeah, we send our kids to public school. So how many of you were educated in public school? You know, at least for some years. Nearly everybody raised their hands. Of course, we've all been educated in public school. I'm a victim of the public school system. I tell people very plainly, I said, I have been recovering from my institutionalization in the public school system for the last 50 years. I was institutionalized, by the way, boys and girls, for the first, well, not the first 12, but from age 6 to age 18, I was institutionalized. So I went on and said, do you have an abolition of children's factory labor in this state? Yeah, yeah. All right. I said, now let's go back to the ninth plank. That one takes a little bit more explanation. I said, it calls for a combination of agriculture with manufacturing industries and the gradual abolition of the distinction between town and country by a more equitable distribution of population over the country. Now, what that is translated into, it calls for urban renewal, population control, metro regional planning programs. And I said, in 1922, here in America, about half the people in the country, 44% to be more specific, about half the people in the country lived on the land. They lived out in the countryside and they farmed or they did whatever they were doing out there. And about half the people in the country lived in urban areas such as the cities and so on. They were doctors and dentists and engineers and factory workers. And over the years, starting about 1920 or so, when our population hit about 100 million people, and you got about 50 million in the country and about 50 million out here in the city. And I said, a metamorphosis began. And what happened was Henry Ford started sucking all the people off the farms and into the cities with his $5 a day plan. And so people, by 1940, and the Great Depression, and the Dust Bowl had sucked those people off the land in the Midwest and put them in Los Angeles and San Francisco and Phoenix, Arizona. And they began to work in those cities. And so that by 1940, there were about 32 million people living on the land. Then World War II came onto the scene. And many people were taken off the land, put into the army, and sent overseas. And when those people came back from the army, instead of going back to the farm, they moved to the cities. They went to college under the GI Bill. So that by 1950, the population of people living on the land had decreased to about 15 million people. Then, between 1950 and 1969, there was a natural gravitation or attraction of people who would be born in the rural areas and on the farms. They would go to public school, they would then go to college, and then they would not go back to the farms because now that they've been to college, they had been trained to be doctors and dentists and engineers and so on, and so they would gravitate then to the cities and go to work for Boeing, Lockheed, and defense industries and so on. So that by 1969, the population on the land had decreased to about 6 million people. And then between 1969 and about 1985, which is about the time I was giving this talk, by the way, about 1985, or 86 or 7 along in there somewhere, the population now has decreased to about 3 million. It's halved again. And the projection is that by the year 2000, there will be about 1 million people living on the land, operating about 200,000 to 300,000 farming economic units, which will be huge corporate farms. I said, do you have anything like that going on here in Utah? And now everybody could resonate with that. Yes, the population of the Mormons in Utah has gravitated from the farms to the cities. And we're now city workers, and we're professionals now. Just like the people in New Jersey and New York and Chicago and Los Angeles. It's the same in Salt Lake City and Provo and Ogden. All right, so we got through, and here is an audience who have just been taken through the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto, and I ask the question, how many of you are practicing communists? And everybody in the room raised their hands.
Okay, that is George Gordon you've been listening to, and you can visit his website at georgegordon.org, and he's got a ton of material, and he talks about everything from, I don't know, he's just a wealth of information, and he's very easy to listen to. It's a very good thing to put on your iPod, and certainly I'll put a link to it on, I'm going to try to put a link to all the things that I am going to be referencing you to today at my website at nowheretorun.podomatic.com. This next clip gets to basically kill two birds with one stone. I think both the interviewer and the interviewee here are both very interesting and worth further study and to look into. And it is from it's from the website franklyspeakingradio.com, which is Frank Whalen and his talk radio show. This is an interview that he did with Joseph Farrell, author of The SS, Brotherhood of the Bell, subtitled The Nazis' Incredible Secret Technology. It's some very interesting things were said in this interview, and I was listening to it over the weekend and just really, really was intrigued by some of the ideas brought up in this interview. And I also liked the interviewer, Frank Whalen, who I had heard about through Zeph Daniel, and Zeph has had him on his show and different things. So that's how I came across him, and this interview I thought was very interesting. I'd like to actually have Joseph Farrell on the show sometime. He seems like he would be a very, very good person to interview. So anyways, this is an interesting clip. It's about 45 minutes long, and I feel it's very important.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You are listening to Frankly Speaking Radio. I am your host, Frank Well, and I'm thrilled that you're with us. It is Friday, June 22nd, 2007, midnight here in the Central Time Zone. Welcome to all of you listening online at www.republicbroadcasting.org. Our phone number, clearly listed there on the website, is 800-313-9443. And while you're online listening, make sure you surf on over to this website, www.adventuresunlimitedpress.com. That website has a wealth of information, including, of course, all of the books written by our author and our guest tonight, Joseph Farrell. The books are as follows: The Giza Death Star, The Giza Death Star Deployed, The Giza Death Star Destroyed, Reich of the Black Sun, The SS Brotherhood of the Bell, and more to follow very soon. Joseph Farrell, welcome back, sir.
Thank you, Frank. It's fun as always to be here.
I really enjoyed it as well, and I really, it means a lot to me that you'd make all this time for us right now. And hey, you know, when we left off, we were just discussing about the media control and the idea that again, a lot of people wouldn't consider. When you think about the coverage of warfare these days, you've got embedded reporters and live feeds and bombs falling and satellite imagery and things like that. Any of these things would just be, you know, they would probably have changed our perception of World War II and other wars as well had we had that kind of coverage, but
right,
we did not, and we were just sort of talking about how as far as the Germans and the Russians battling against each other in World War II, there's a lot of things that went on there that nobody really knows about. And, you know, what we do know indicates that again, there was some significant weaponry being utilized at the time.
Right. Well, you know, I mentioned the fuel air bombs, and this is another aspect of the story that we're not told. The conventional history of the fuel air bomb is that it was a development, an offshoot of the American nuclear program in the 1970s. But in actuality, fuel air bombs have been around since World War II, and most specifically developed by fascist Italy and Nazi Germany. These two countries brought them to a point where they were deliverable weapons systems as early as 1941, as I just mentioned, by citing Colonel Otto Skorzeny.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing I should point out about fuel air bombs is that the Germans tested one of these things, I think it was in 1944, and I mentioned this in the SS Brotherhood of the Bell. They tested one of these things in 1944 that was so large that it devastated an area of 12 kilometers in diameter, and photographs were taken of this test for Reichsfuhrer Himmler. So in other words, they're not playing around with small little tactical nuke-type fuel air bombs.
Yeah,
they're,
really,
they're dealing with things that are just enormously huge.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it really is. It's a story that, you know, any way we approach it, we are dealing almost at every turn with some form of suppressed military technology whose true history we don't know unless we start digging into some of this stuff that was going on in World War II.
Well said. Very well said. Because honestly, I mean, most of the time you would hear something, and this is, you know, fairly, I think, accurate based on the number of times I've heard it and the number of times I've seen it implemented and bear out, is that when you hear about something that the military is doing here in the United States in this day and age of extensive media coverage, they're usually about 20 years ahead of that.
Right, now, exactly.
Yeah, so you think about all of the accomplishments that humankind has made, certainly all of the accomplishments we've made, right, you know, from around the World War II era up till now, and you can see we're talking about, you know, more than leaps and bounds, we're talking about, you know, giant strides forward. So as a result of that, if these technologies existed back then, which it appears that they did, and then some, they must be almost hundreds of years ahead these days compared to where they would have been then. And we'll explore this when we come back. Folks, stay with us. More Frankly Speaking Radio. And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Glad you're here with us tonight. You are listening, of course, to Frankly Speaking Radio. The website, of course, for the show, franklyspeakingradio.com. Amazing stuff from our special guest tonight, author of numerous books, Joseph P. Farrell, joining us. Joseph, welcome back, sir.
Thank you, Frank. It's fun, like always.
Yeah, I'm really enjoying it myself. It's amazing stuff. You know, one of the things I wanted to ask you about was, in essence, the Nazis building flying saucers or UFOs.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, it's a big one, and I'll tell you what inspired me to think of along these lines, you know, going through some of the news and whatnot. I came across this story, and I'll try to be relatively brief with it, but here's what it says. This came out, it's at prgb.com, I don't even know what that is, but it came out June 14th, so I guess it was, what, a week ago, last Thursday. It says, Buzz Aldrin was scheduled for a phone interview on the Friday, June 8th, 2007 edition of Your World with Neil Cavuto on the Fox News cable channel. Originally booked to talk about the latest space shuttle launch, he suddenly found himself being asked about Paris Hilton and had some interesting things to say. It says Friday was should have been a big news day. A former preacher's wife was sentenced to 3 years in prison for shooting her husband in the back while he slept. A tax protester couple in New Hampshire discovered what happens when you challenge the authority of the people you elect to office. You get state police and an army of federal troops with tanks and federal agents with submachine guns at your door. The space shuttle took off on a mission to support the International Space Station. It was announced that the current chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff was stepping down. East Coast air travel practically brought to a standstill by a computer glitch. None of those news pieces ended up being the biggest story of the day. Instead, it was Paris Hilton. Apparently, it took Fox and other news gathering and reporting organizations 8 hours to tell the tale of naughty Paris and the nasty judge. Regardless of how you feel about the Paris affair, it may have paid off in an unusual way for UFO researchers. Buzz Aldrin was supposed to be talking about the latest space shuttle mission. Imagine his surprise when the famous astronaut's guest spot was jammed in the middle of the never-ending discussion about Paris Hilton. An experienced media guest, Buzz is never at a loss for prefabricated words, and it's written by a guy named Bill Nell. And he says, years ago, I appeared on the Sally Jesse Raphael show with him and a few other UFO researchers. As long as you didn't ask him anything out of the ordinary, he had some terrific prepared responses. If you did, he stammered and stumbled. That's what happened on Your World with Neil Cavuto today around 1:30 p.m. Arizona time. When asked to comment how he felt about living in a world where Paris dominates the news for hours on end, asked by, again, one of the news agencies that's covering Paris Hilton for hours on end, ironically enough, he began by stammering on about some science fiction book he wrote once. The story was about a civilization that was going to be destroyed in exactly 140 years by a terrible calamity. The point was that everyone knew about it and did nothing until the last minute. And he writes, huh? But he says, Buzz continued and finally made a lucid point. He apparently feels we have lost our focus. Instead of worrying about how the Russians, the Chinese, and the Japanese are slowly overtaking us in space research and exploration, we sensationalize and promote not events like today's Paris debacle. Just as Your World was headed to a break, Aldrin reminisced about the days of the Apollo 11 moon mission and said, quote, suppose Neil and I said, look at what's outside our window, it's a UFO. Instead, we said, it's unusual to see a booster rocket outside of our window. Think about what people would have said and what they would have done if we told them it was a UFO following us. That's what it was. End quote. That's a pretty big story, right? And I mean,
yep. Yep.
you get a guy who's, you know, maybe he's getting up there in age and he forgets certain things, or maybe, you know, he just feels it's time to give the people some real news, you know, seeing this stuff and being just disgusted by the non-news that
right.
we all are. But, you know, again, that is really intriguing because he mentions about the Chinese, the Russians, the Japanese overtaking us in space technology. Obviously, they're not the only ones. A lot of people are interested in this. And this all goes back to, of course, the Nazis and you know, a variety of other things. The Vrilcraft, which we've heard about and seen pictures of. The idea of bases in Antarctica, which are, now that global warming is happening, a lot of people are starting to look into that a lot more.
Oh, yeah.
We've got, yeah, people are, the Canadians are challenging for, you know, rights there, as are the Americans, the Russians. Everybody wants it. So it makes you wonder, what exactly is there?
Well,
I know that's the longest question and introduction to a question. But take us anywhere you want to go.
Well, in answer to what might be there, you know, we can go back to the story of the German 1938 expedition to Antarctica. They outfit a seaplane tender with a scientific laboratory and send down a scientific team. They send airplanes over a portion of Antarctica that they will eventually claim for themselves and call Neuschwabenland. And they do a lot of photo reconnaissance of this area. They capture and shoot penguins and walruses and so on to take back to freeze and take back to Germany to find out if they can make something nutritional for human survival there. So they put a lot of expense and effort into this expedition. Now, it's rumored that when they did so, that these planes on their photo reconnaissance overflights discovered a lot of warm water spring-fed little lakes and underwater lakes and caverns and canyons and so on underneath the ice, which is very likely, and that they found additionally how these things were interconnected to the Atlantic Trench and so on. So the Germans spent a lot of effort to explore Antarctica, and then when the mission returned to Germany, it was welcomed back, it appeared in the newsreels for a day or two, and then all of a sudden, nothing more was ever heard about this expedition. Not even after the war. You have to dig like crazy to find out anything about it, even to find a map of how it got down there. And the most unusual feature is that the expedition is sponsored by none other than Reichsmarschall Hermann Göring, who, of course, is the head of the German Air Force, and Rudolf Hess, who, of course, at that time is the chairman of the Nazi Party. So these two, to use the term very loosely, these two gentlemen are not interested in sponsoring a science fair project. They have some other agenda in mind, but no one really knows what it is.
Mm.
Now, during the war, the German Navy had many U-boats that operated in the South Atlantic, whose missions and mission diaries are very peculiar because no one really knows why they were down that far south, and they were operating in Antarctic waters. At the end of the war, many of these U-boats disappeared for months. There are cases of U-boats showing up and surrendering in Argentina fully 3 months after the end of the war, and when questioned by the Argentine and later American and British authorities, these U-boat captains just kind of hemmed and hawed and obfuscated and basically said, well, we were just sort of sailing around. Well, no, they probably were doing something in Antarctica. Nobody knows what. And so the suspicion has always been that the Nazis established some sort of U-boat base there. In addition to that, there are statements by Grand Admiral Dönitz himself, who was the commander-in-chief of the German U-boat fleet during the war, and who, of course, I mentioned earlier, was ultimately Hitler's successor after Hitler committed suicide. Grand Admiral Dönitz himself was quoted as saying that the German Navy was building for the Führer a Shangri-La in a world of eternal ice. So, in other words, the strong possibility is there that the Germans were constructing some sort of base. Now, as we've mentioned on your show before, after the war, the American Admiral Byrd led a full fully equipped and outfitted military expedition to that continent, which included a light escort aircraft carrier, several destroyers, a submarine, two seaplane tenders, and a battalion of Marines, no less. And it was outfitted for an expedition of about 8 months. When he got there, he spent only 8 weeks hightailed it out of there. On the way back to the United States, he gives an interview for a Chilean newspaper called El Mercurio in Santiago de Chile, and he says that the United States should prepare itself for action of enemy fighters that can fly from pole to pole with tremendous speed. When he gets back to this country, all of the operational logs of this operation in 1947, early 1947, are classified, and they remain so to this day. So my suspicion is that we outfitted a military expedition to go to Antarctica, find out whatever it was that the Nazis were doing there and what they probably were still doing at that time there, and that we ran into some opposition that we really didn't expect, that, that thoroughly outclassed us, and we just beat a hasty retreat. So something was definitely going on.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it is. It is. And that it should be classified to this day should tell us something, that whatever it was that that was the reason for Byrd getting out of there, it had to have been extremely significant.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, not to mention the fact that somehow you, in my long drawn out question, you've managed to address both answers to that question, which is again about the existence of what we would deem today to be flying saucers or UFOs. What you're talking about is planes that or aircraft that can make that trip. All over the place.
The other thing about the flying saucer question. If we look just at the aerospace technology that we took over from Nazi Germany, we took, as part of our Operation Paperclip scientists that came over here, one professor in particular was a fellow by the name of Walter Lippisch, who had, and I mentioned this in the SS Brotherhood of the Bell, he had designed these supersonic ramjet-powered aircraft that were designed to exceed the speed of sound. And there's every indication that, in fact, towards the end of the war in early 1945, that they actually test flew some of these planes and exceeded the sound barrier at a very early date. In other words, prior to Chuck Yeager in the official history doing it in 1947 or 48, I forget the exact date. Mm-hmm. So again, there's a hidden history to the military technology that we begin to develop after the war, and most of it is coming from Nazi Germany. So all of this is just very peculiar. But Lippisch raises the point of the flying saucers, because while I personally do not we'll wait for after the break, sounds like.
It's going by quick, my friends. Stay with us. Back in 3 minutes with more Frankly Speaking Radio and our special guest, Joseph Farrell. Welcome back, my friends. Glad you're with us here tonight. A stunning and amazing conversation with Joseph Farrell. And Joseph, we should probably give out the phone number for people to order your books, because they are all just incredible, absolutely amazing.
I know it's 1-800-718-4514, and all the books are $16.95 each, and there is a 10% discount on orders of three or more. And if they want to go online, it's www.adventuresunlimitedpress.com.
Wonderful, wonderful stuff. These books are all must-have, folks. Yeah, I'm telling you, it's just amazing the way you can just go from one apparently very disparate subject to another and make all these connections. And I just am such a fan of your work, my friend.
But, Thank you.
Oh, it's just being honest. Please continue, though. I apologize.
Well, one of the things I wanted to point out about Professor Lippisch and the UFO connection is that the airplanes that he was designing toward the end of the war were designed to travel approximately 1,200 miles per hour. Now, if we examine the many newspaper reports during the UFO flaps in this country after the war, the flaps in 47 and again in 52 and so on, many of these newspaper reports have a peculiarity that I find very, very odd and too odd to be coincidental. Many of them mention speeds for the UFOs that they see as being extraordinary, but the speed that they mention is 1,200 miles an hour. So in other words, I think it might possibly be explainable that the American military continued to test some of these Nazi designs that they had brought over with them during Operation Paperclip after the war. Now, you had mentioned also the Vril aircraft and so on. I'm not one of those that tends to place much authenticity in some of the photos that have been circulated of so-called Nazi flying saucers. But that being said, the SS did have a project that was being run by an Austrian scientist by the name of Victor Schauberger, who was trying to design for the SS a disc-shaped aerodyne that was based on a bladeless turbine, if one can wrap one's mind around that. But he was apparently successful in this effort because toward the end of the war, he apparently tested one of these devices in, you guessed it, Prague, where the device actually took off, flew through the roof of the test facility, and just continued on its merry way.
Wow.
So, yeah, it apparently was so successful that they brought this Schauberger man to this country to try and gain his secrets. So, again, what the Nazis achieved during the war and what we've been told they achieved are two very, very different things.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it really is. It's a story of suppressed technology that really kind of rivals Tesla.
Yeah, it really does. And
yeah.
That's really the stunning thing, too, is because when you look at it, you can see a definitive change in the way that we had technology brought to us here in America. And a lot of
right.
people view that as, oh, it's the post-World War II boom. You know, it's just people are excited about not being at war anymore and all these great new technologies are coming out. But, again, it's moderately suspicious as far as timing goes.
Well, it's suspicious, but it's suspicious in a way that points the finger almost always to the technology transfer that occurred from Nazi Germany to this country at the end of the war. And I've mentioned this before, but I'll mention it again. In SS Brotherhood of the Bell, I point out that the Germans had perfected as early as 1940 a tiny little klystron tube, which is a vacuum tube, about the size of the knuckle on your little finger. And the Allied equivalent of this tube at the end of the war is 10 times as big. So the Germans are not only doing A-bomb research and ramjets and jets and everything else that you can think of, they're miniaturizing their electronic components to an extraordinary degree. And, you know, that little tube to me is a clear sign that they're on the technology tree to the transistor, which would explain in a very different way and a much more satisfactory way, I think, than Colonel Corso's day after Roswell, that we got this from crashed alien saucers. No.
Yeah.
We got this technology largely from the Nazis.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it really is. It really is. And you know, the hidden aspect of this story, Frank, is that when we brought these paperclip scientists over, we really sold our soul to the devil.
Mm-hmm.
Because we cannot bring their physics, which is based on an ideology that really is founded in the Nazi Party itself, without bringing the ideology too. And that's the aspect of the story, I think, that's most frightening.
Yeah, that is a really fascinating point, and one that I don't think is ever really acknowledged, or even I've never even heard it before. Other than from you, but I mean, you think about what that means, folks. The idea that anything to get the jump on our enemies, whomever they might be, real or imagined, leads you to adopt that mindset of the end justifying the means, and that's pretty frightening.
Yep.
Hang on a second, folks. We're back in three with our special guest Joseph Farrell and more Frankly Speaking Radio.
Do it, baby.
Well, Welcome back. Glad you're here, folks. You are listening to Frankly Speaking Radio. I am your host, Frank Whalen, and I'm thrilled you're with us for a variety of different reasons, mostly solely because of our guest and his information, but really captivating stuff. Before we get back to that, let me remind you that this hour is being brought to you by our good friend Grant Hall, author of the book Privacy Crisis. The website, www.privacycrisis.com. You can order the ebook there or the hardcover version of the book. You can also look for it used at Amazon.com, or you can call this particular Borders bookstore and have it shipped to you by calling 702-433-6222. But really, the easiest way is to just go down to your local bookstore and demand that they order you a copy of Privacy Crisis by Grant Hall. You can learn all of the techniques by way of his experiences and all the things that he had. These are proven, tried and true tactics to make yourself completely anonymous, invisible, and in this day and age of surveillance, people, you know, who push the envelope, people who are not afraid to speak their mind. It's a dangerous time, folks. You can learn how to travel, bank, work, and live anonymously right here in the United States simply by picking up this book and then reading it. It's called Privacy Crisis by Grant Hall. And, of course, we appreciate his generosity in sponsoring this hour of the program. And we ask you to support all of our sponsors and advertisers, the people who make the show and the network possible. Joseph Farrell is our guest tonight, a prolific author, and we've discussed a great many things already tonight. Welcome back to you, sir.
Thank you, Frank. Fun as always.
Thank you so much for being here. What's that?
I say it's going too fast.
It is going fast. It is going fast. If I can, you know, redirect here for a second.
Sure.
I was wondering about the, is there evidence of a Nazi space program?
Oh, boy. Yes, there is. Let's look at the so-called medical experiments that the Nazi doctors, so-called doctors, did in the concentration camps. Some of the experiments are just truly grisly when you read about them and some of the things they did. But what they were doing was they were laying the foundations, really, of modern space medicine, and it's for that reason that many of these doctors made their way to this country and its space program as part of Operation Paperclip, Strughold being one of the most famous examples of one of these doctors. There were many of them that did so. So in terms of space medicine, they were doing that, and of course we know about their rockets. They were developing even an early prototypical version of a space shuttle. So they had their fingers on almost every aspect of the technology tree that would be necessary for a space program. Now, that being said, I think that some of their more advanced projects, things like the Schauberger saucer and the Bell and things like this, that these things also represent a necessary component of their thinking, because what they were trying to do with those projects was look beyond rocket technology, which they knew would have been an absolutely inefficient means for any practical interplanetary travel, even in our own local celestial neighborhood. So, yes, they did have a program. I think that there is even a certain amount of evidence that this program continued to be more or less quasi-independent after the war. And the reason I say that is that, and I've mentioned this on a previous program, but if we look at the early competition between the United States and the Soviet Union, particularly in launching lunar probes, unmanned lunar probes, if we compare the launch schedules of these Soviet and American probes, it's almost as if they are being secretly coordinated from some center, because the Americans would launch a series and kind of sit back, and then the Russians would launch a series and kind of sit back, and then we'd do the same thing again. And it continues for such a length of time that it's very, very peculiar. It's almost as if there is some coordination between the two. And that raises the issue then of what is the coordinating body or entity. And the only thing that historically in the evidence that would present itself to be such an entity would be the fact that in both space programs you have a foundation on what the Nazis were doing in World War II, and you have also a foundation on the fact that both countries imported a great deal of some of these Nazi scientists and engineers and technicians into their space programs.
Wow.
Yeah, it's, again, you know, it's, I'm not trying to come up with a conspiracy theory here, but it should be noted that even Richard C. Hoagland has on many occasions given talks on various talk radio shows and published articles on his website to the effect that there appears to be some sort of secret space program in place in this country and that it has been there almost from the inception. Now, one of the things I point out in the SS Brotherhood of the Bell particularly is that almost from the start, the German scientists that we brought into NASA and into our military projects as well behaved quasi-independently of their American handlers. At one point, the Germans were even trying to produce the Saturn V by themselves in-house in NASA, and they had to be stopped. So all of this activity suggests to me that there is some coordinating entity and that it does have something to do with this Nazi International.
Jeez.
Yeah, it's scary. Mm-hmm. There's just no other way of putting it. It's just plain scary.
You know, one of the things that has really captivated me is just how much we don't know about the things that, as we had mentioned, I guess sort of at the tail end of the last hour, it's hard to believe it was 40 minutes ago, but we were talking about, you know, how much the advancing, the technology has advanced, obviously, since the paperclip era till
right.
now. And it stands to reason that at some level they're going to start delving into areas that, well, you know, they probably already have. The people would consider it to be just fiction, complete and total fiction.
Right.
And I think that's when it starts to really get interesting on a number of different levels. Because a lot of the things that we see out there in Hollywood, as we've said, you know, a lot of these things are put out there in a fictional form in order to dismiss it as a possibility in the real world.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right. Yes, exactly. So.
When you start looking at these things, it raises a lot of questions. And,
right.
And, you know, you and I have discussed some of these things before. But certainly the Bell Project is one of the most captivating things. And you've just done such amazing research on this. And of course, everybody that you've sourced is, you know, helped you in acquiring some of this information. But, I mean, you've taken this thing in completely new directions, and I wonder if you could maybe tell us a little bit about that for those who have never heard you on this program before.
Well, the Bell is, of all of Nazi Germany's secret research projects during the war, it is the most sensational by far, for the simple reason that the Nazis themselves gave it a security classification unique to that project alone and higher than any other project in Nazi Germany, including what I believe to have been a successful atomic bomb program on the part of Nazi Germany.
Yeah.
They classified it as Kriegsentscheidend, which translates as war decisive. That was their evaluation of this device, and there's every indication from the literature that and research that I and others have done that when the Nazi propaganda machine was talking about the Wunderwaffe, or the wonder weapon, that they were talking precisely about this project. What the Bell was physically, it was a bell-shaped object, and hence it was called the Bell. It was a bell-shaped object with a metallic ceramic casing, inside of which there were two counter-rotating drums into which they put a serum, a chemical compound that they codenamed Serum 525. Now, nobody knows what this substance was, but it is described in the war crimes affidavit in Poland as having been kind of reddish-violet in its color, a kind of a liquid gel. It was spun by these two counter-rotating cylinders at very high speeds and subjected, I believe, to extremely high voltage AC and DC current. And as a result of this, I think that what the Nazis were trying to do, based on some principles of physics that I get into in the SS Brotherhood of the Bell, and incidentally in the book I'm writing now, kind of a sequel to it, I've got some more information to share. But what they were trying to do was achieve an effect that basically would achieve a local bending of the fabric of space and time. In other words, they were trying to control gravity. But in the Nazi thinking, this to them was a weapon. It was not a weapons platform, but a weapon itself. Now imagine that if you can control the fabric of space and time itself, if you can control the type of energy that is present at any point in space, then you have a weaponization potential that would make a hydrogen bomb look like a firecracker. So they were literally tinkering around with doomsday physics. They wanted, and they were pursuing with all the technological expertise that Germany could muster, and of course that was considerable. They were pursuing a doomsday weapon and principles of physics that are so very different from anything that we have learned in the public consumption physics literature that it has remained a project that until very recently was totally unknown. The reason why, and this again will emphasize the high priority that the Nazis placed on this thing, the reason why is that at the end of the war, the SS murdered approximately 60 of the scientists and technicians that were involved with the project itself. The Bell itself disappeared along with this SS General Kammler, who was in charge of all of these secret weapons projects for Nazi Germany, and a huge Junkers six-engine 390 heavy lift ultra-long-range aircraft. The Bell, the General, the aircraft, and all of the project documentation for this device went completely missing at the end of the war. No one really knows where it went. The best two avenues that we can see from the evidence is that it either disappeared in this country and into its black projects, or it disappeared into South America into some ongoing and continuing independent Nazi project. Either option really is rather frightening, but they were dealing with areas of physics, again, that would make a hydrogen bomb look like a kitchen match.
That's just stunning. Now,
it's very, very frightening. And again, you know, it's an example of taking, if it came to this country, then we made the Faustian bargain with the devil.
Yeah. And there's obviously going to be repercussions to all this as well.
Right.
Now, you mentioned about bending the fabric of space and time in conjunction with anti-gravity. What's the connection there between space and time and gravity?
Well, in general relativity, mm-hmm. If you accelerate any mass to near the speed of light, the equations of special relativity will show you that that mass will approach infinity. Now, the other thing that physics will tell you is that a rotating mass actually loses some of its mass. So what the Germans were doing, I believe, and I get into this a lot more in this new book I'm writing, because I'm placing it into a context of another famous experiment during the war to demonstrate some of these principles. But I believe that what the Germans were trying to do was, by counter-rotating in those two drums a substance which I believe to have been some compound of mercury, probably a radioactive isotope of mercury that was doped with other materials like possibly thorium or polonium or something like that, that what they were trying to do was to make that substance go into a plasma state, which would then cohere the spin of electrons and then of the nucleus of the ions in that plasma. In other words, cohering means to make the spin go all one direction. So if we have these two counter-rotating drums with this plasma, which would then constitute most of the mass of the object, go in exactly the same direction, but in the two cylinders in opposite direction, what you're going to be doing is you're zero vectoring. You're canceling out, essentially, the electromagnetic force of all of the mass of that object. So it basically achieves a contrabaric or anti-gravity effect. The thing begins to lift. Now, it's interesting because the Polish concentration camp inmates that worked around the area where the Bell was tested actually say that during the night the Germans were testing some sort of barrel-like or barrel-looking device which they could see ascend from the ground above the tree line glowing with a pale blue glow. Mm. Now, the other thing that the Bell did was it gave off absolutely toxic effects. Plants or organic matter that were placed in the proximity of the Bell for testing would literally within a matter of mere hours turn to kind of a blackish gray goo or grease. In other words, they decayed so quickly that they turned into a kind of a jelly, and they did so without putrefaction.
Wow.
So, you know, any way you look at whatever the Nazis were doing with this thing, they were playing around with some areas of physics that are just absolutely mind-bogglingly advanced for their day. They're literally 60 years ahead of the game in 1944.
Wow.
Yeah, it's scary.
It is scary. Well, I wanted to ask you this, and this may seem kind of weird, but you mentioned that the organic matter decayed, and now I wonder if there's a connection there between, again, time.
Right.
If you're manipulating time, then
right.
it would be almost like, you know, speeding up time for...
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. You hit the nail right on the head, because one of the principles of physics that is involved here is torsion, which is kind of a complicated mathematical tensor transform. But essentially what it boils down to is that in torsion fields, you can skip ahead in time, but not backwards. So if this is the explanation for the effects of the bell, if they are speeding time up locally to that degree, then the first thing that we have to notice is that they have stepped entirely outside of the paradigm of general relativity, because general relativity will not permit that kind of very localized laboratory bench engineering of those kinds of effects. They can only occur in general relativity in the presence of extremely large masses such as a planet or a star. In other words, if you recall the famous solar eclipse experiment that they used to verify Einstein's prediction that a large mass would bend light. Well, this is the other thing that's taking place with the bell. It's creating such an extremely localized space-time curvature that once you learn how to control it, you can literally create a torsion bomb. You'd have the means of blowing up a planet with this stuff.
Just a second here, my friend. We have to pause for a break. But, yeah, obviously, the implications of this are just stunning. We'll be back with the end of hour number two, folks. Stay with us. Good morning, my friends, and welcome back. You are listening to Frankly Speaking Radio, tail end of hour number two already, and we have just been captivated by our special guest this evening, Joseph Farrell. Our phone number, and we'll try to get some calls in here in the last hour coming up, 800-313-9443, toll-free and worldwide, 1-800-313-9443. And the website, of course, where you can pick up these incredible books, AdventuresUnlimitedPress.com. The books are as follows: The Giza Death Star, The Giza Death Star Deployed, The Giza Death Star Destroyed, Reich of the Black Sun, and The SS Brotherhood of the Bell, and, of course, more to follow. Joseph, welcome back, sir.
Frank, I can't believe it's already the
end of
the second hour.
I know. It's absolutely amazing. But, you know, what's most stunning about it, of course, is, you know, these most recent things we just discussed here. So, in essence, in order to achieve anti-gravity, you have to have the ability to bend space and time. And, of course, to be able to achieve that gives you a glimpse, I guess, or some sort of, you know, window into the future, I guess, is, you know, you'll say it better than I will. And, of course, it can equate to a planet-destroying type of weapon. I mean, on par with that. I mean, that big, that intense, and that, you know, important, I suppose.
Right. Right. Basically, what we're looking at is a physics whose, if you can learn how to control it, if you can learn how to manipulate it, and the details that I give in the SS Brotherhood of the Bell give every indication that the Nazis were mastering that technique. But this physics would allow you to apply it in any number of different ways. You could weaponize it, certainly. You could use it for more or less free energy, so to speak. You could use it, certainly, as a means of field propulsion. There are any number of applications that this technology represents, so it is no wonder that the Third Reich classified it absolutely uniquely at the very pinnacle of all of these vast super secret weapons projects that they had going. This was the one project that they took great pains to make sure did not fall into the hands of the Soviet Union. And they took probably as equal great pains, on my view, to keep it from the hands of the Western allies. So it is an awesome, awesome technology and an awesome, awesome physics that it represents.
Yeah, and then some.
And then some.
Yeah, I'm just blown away. You know, and obviously when you look at all the things that have come out in regards to time travel and whatnot, it does make you wonder exactly how they know certain things. And certainly, folks, when you look at it, you've got the Pentagon Climate Report, okay, the report on abrupt climate change. This is the Pentagon, okay, weighing in on climate, and it's classified.
Right. And
even the unclassified version begins to give you incredible details, such as, things will start to get bad at this point you can expect this and this and this. And so far, they've been spot on, just for the last few years, which I think is very suspicious. Now, I've heard other things, people have seen other things as well, indicating that the whole, again, the war on terror, the acquisition of natural resources in preparation for what? It just makes you wonder exactly who is running the whole thing. What do they know? What have they seen? And why aren't they sharing? But we're coming up on a break, my friend. When we come back, I'd like to talk about some other things. And maybe, again, we're astounded by the idea of the Nazis being able to perpetrate some of these things in the 40s and the 30s, whatever. What about when we go back to ancient times and the idea and the evidence of weapons of mass destruction?
A message for...
Okay, sorry, that interview ends a little abruptly there. But if you want to listen to the rest of it, you can go to Frank Whalen's website, and he is the interviewer in that clip. And his website is franklyspeakingradio.com, and there he has archives to the rest of his interviews, and also that interview with Joseph Farrell, author of the SS Brotherhood of the Bell. Okay, moving on. The next and last clip is from Chuck Missler, and I was also listening to this weekend and found it very interesting. He's talking about different things dealing with the occult and rituals as it relates to some of the things, and specifically talks a good deal about Halloween, which I think is appropriate because in true Chuck Missler style, he just nails the details down on this stuff, and I'm just a huge fan of Chuck Missler, and one of the reasons it's interesting, as I to use his terms, but you can find a ton of material of Chuck Missler talking about literally every topic that has ever been talked about. He has hours of audio on that topic somewhere on the internet. And you can go to his website where he offers some of that stuff in the radio program, and then he also sells some of it as well, but you can find it in different places on the internet. But his website is khouse.org, the letter K, house.org. Anyway, here's Chuck Missler in this very interesting clip. And this will last about, I think it's going to cut off abruptly, but it's going to last about 40 minutes, and then that'll be the end of the show. So, enjoy.
I think most of us are very sensitive to the fact that we are immersed in a pagan culture. And it's really rather fascinating to look around us. In fact, it's a startling discovery, if you start doing a little bit of homework, and discovering that how much of our lives, the labels to our days of the week, our months, go back to Roman and other pagan traditions. I think most of us that have done any research at all, of course, know that Christmas is, in fact, deeply immersed in all kinds of Babylonian and other pagan traditions. The Christmas tree itself originated from ancient tree cults. The term Druid may surprise you, originally referred to a priest of the oak cult. The custom of kissing someone under the mistletoe can be traced back to Druid beliefs that sexual potency and other things reverence for that plant. Easter, I think most of us probably realize that Ishtar was one of the goddesses of the Babylonian religion, and the golden egg of Astarte was a fertility symbol originated in fertility cults. And if you understand the symbol of the rabbit as a symbol of fertility, you can understand how both eggs and rabbits became symbolic of these ancient pagan fertility cults, and that's how you get Easter bunnies. I mean, you ever wonder where you get bunnies that lay eggs? You know, that's sort of a strange idea that we sort of take for granted in the various practices and games that are played around that time of year. The practice of sending Valentine's Day cards goes back characteristically to a licentious Roman feast called Lupercalia. Birthday cakes may have derived from offering candles and cakes to Artemis, an ancient Greek goddess of the moon and the hunt. The custom of giving out cigars at baby's birth may come from ancient Mayan fathers who would blow tobacco smoke toward the sun god as an offering of thanks for the newborn child. Our childhood tooth fairy, strange enough, goes back to attempts to hide physical items from practitioners of voodoo who would use such items for their curse rituals and so forth. The idea of June brides is related to Juno, the Roman goddess of marriage. Most aspects of the American wedding ceremony can be traced to ancient pagan customs, including the bride's white dress and veil, the exchanging of wedding rings, and the father giving the bride away. So there's all these, many of these ideas go back to pagan issues. And with that sort of candid survey of the culture in which we live, once a year, we as Bible-believing Christians get confronted with a particular pagan celebration that should be giving us some difficulties. And that is, once a year, we face the dilemma, the problem, the burden of dealing with a holiday called Halloween. And it's obviously very easy to shrug this off as just another one of these quaint vestiges of days gone by. But it's interesting. I thought we would tonight explore a little bit on some of the background that will relate to decisions that you're going to have to make this year again. The celebration of the pagan festival of Halloween is now a $2.4 billion market, merchandiser's dream. Over 50% of Americans will decorate for Halloween as compared to 80% for Christmas. It is now the third most popular party activity, following only the Super Bowl and New Year's Eve. Halloween is big business, and I wish that was where it ended. It's always a difficult time, especially for Christians, and especially those with children. How do you deal with this? I'm also going to suggest that it's also a very dangerous time, because many of the seemingly harmless involvements that tend to get associated with Halloween can be entries, the technical term used by some, for entries of the occult. And some of these things can prove very tragic for the unwary. It's interesting that you could easily make a list of superstitions and strange ideas that were extant during the days of ancient Israel. What do you suppose would be the penalty for someone who ran around the camp of Israel arguing that the world is flat? Probably nothing. You and I could probably conjure up a list of superstitions or weird ideas that were a symptom of ignorance or being uninformed that were apparently would be dismissed as harmless. But if you were involved in something that smacked of witchcraft or astrology or necromancy, trying to communicate with the dead, what was the result in the state in the camp of Israel? Death. Death. It was a capital crime. It's interesting that God didn't set those rather severe punishments for ignorance, but rather to protect them from tampering with something that was dangerous. I thought it would be fruitful for us to spend a little bit of time taking a look at the roots, the background of this holiday that is relatively recent as an American holiday. And actually, the background of Halloween starts in ancient Britain and Ireland, the Celtic festival of Samhain. It was observed on October 31st, which was the end of summer. In Cornwall, it was called Allantide, of apple time. In Ireland, it was known as Gimbrel. November 1st was the new year. In both Celtic and Anglo-Saxon calendars, and the date was connected with return of the herds from pasture, and the laws and land tenures were renewed at that time. It was one of the most important times of the year in the Celtic culture, and yet we'll also discover it was also one of the most sinister times of the year. The Celts were the first Aryan people who came from Asia to settle in Europe. Settling in northern France and the British Isles, the Celtic people engaged in occultic arts. They worshipped nature, ascribing to it supernatural or animistic qualities, very much like your federal government is enforcing in the schools today. You might reflect on that as we go. The ancient Druids were a priestly class of the Celtic religion. Many of their beliefs and practices were similar to those of Hinduism. In fact, there's some very fascinating echoes throughout the Celtic religion of what we know today in the Hindu beliefs. They taught reincarnation and the transmigration of the soul. That people can be reborn as animals. That was a very common thought. It's a common thought in Hinduism. It also was a common theme in the Celtic religion. Now, according to Julius Caesar and other sources, the Celts believed that they descended from the god Dis, which is the Roman name for the god of the dead. It's interesting that the Druids and the Celts venerated memory very highly. And as a result, they left relatively modest, very hardly any, written records. Most of what we know came from the Romans, which did a great deal of documentation of these strange people in the British Isles. One of the things, just to give you just a flavor of some of this, one of the things that was very dominant among the Druids was human sacrifice. Now, we read that very glibly, but until you get into the background, you haven't got a glimpse of what was involved here. According to the Roman historian Tacitus, the Druids covered their altars with the blood of their victims, often criminals, if they were available. According to Caesar, human sacrifice was a common and frequent element. In large cages, scores of people were burned alive at once. The larger the number of victims, the greater the yield of the crops, was the thought. According to Lucan, a first century Latin poet, three Celt gods in particular were hungry for human souls, Tetis, Essus, and Tyrannus. The struggles of the dying victims were held to contain predictions of the future. The Druids had full confidence in sacrifice, human sacrifice, as a method of divination. Quote, horrible indeed was the method by which the Druids divined the future events after a human sacrifice. The Druids, says Tacitus, consult the gods in the palpitating entrails of the men, while Strabo informs us that they stabbed a human victim in the back with a sword and then drew omens from the convulsive movements made by him in his death struggles. Diodorus says that they augured from the posture in which the victim fell, from his contortions, and from the direction in which the blood flowed from the body. From these, they formed the predictions according to certain rules left to them by the ancestors. So you get the flavor of these practices. These practices are still practiced today by certain Satanist and neo-pagan groups. Now, the Druids believed that October 31st, the night before their new year and the last day of the old year, Samhain, the Lord of Death, gathered the souls of the evil dead that had been condemned to enter the bodies of animals. It was believed that he would then decide what animal form they would take for the next year. The souls of the good dead were reincarnated as humans. That was the conceptions that they held. The Druids also believed that the punishment of the evil dead would be lightened by sacrifices, prayers, and gifts to the Lord of Death, Samhain. Now, this begins to reveal the strange link that seems to emerge in later years, between some of these Druid practices associated with Samhain and purgatory and some of the beliefs of the Roman Church, the non-biblical aspects of those views. Now, the Druid worshippers attempted to placate and appease Samhain, the Lord of Death, because of his power over the souls of the dead, whether these souls were good or evil. For those who die in the preceding 12 months, Samhain allowed these spirits to return to the earth, to their former places of habitation, for a few hours to associate once again with their families. When, of course? At the close of that year, on October 31st. Now, it was on these occasions that ancient fire festivals with huge bonfires set on hilltops were set up to frighten away the evil spirits. The souls of the dead were supposed to visit their homes that day, and the autumnal festival acquired a sinister significance with ghosts, witches, goblins, cats, black cats, fairies, demons of all kinds were said to be roaming about. It was a time to placate the supernatural powers controlling the processes of nature. The hilltop Halloween fires of the Scots were called Samhainagan, which suggesting again the lingering influence of the ancient Celtic festivals. On this night, evil or frustrated ghosts were supposed to play tricks on humans to cause supernatural manifestations. And as part of that celebration, people donned grotesque masks and danced around huge bonfires to scare away the evil spirits. In some cases, food was put out to allow the good dead that Samhain had released to feel welcome at home. You're beginning to get the picture of how they handled this situation. Halloween also was thought to be the most favorable time for divinations regarding marriage, luck, health, and death. It was considered the only day on which the help of the devil could be invoked for such purposes. That's a strange superstition or thought that emerges in all of this. Now, it's interesting, other festivals throughout the world celebrate a time when the dead return to mingle with the living, it would seem. The Hindus had their night of holy. The Iroquois Indians celebrate a feast of the dead every 12 years. In Mexico, the Day of the Dead begins on November 2nd, and on it goes. In Russia, all the witches are said to gather once a year. In fact, this is celebrated in Mussorgsky's famous music composition, Night on a Bear Mountain. It's a delightful musical composition. In fact, you may recall it was featured as one of the segments in Fantasia, Walt Disney's Fantasia, Night on the Bear Mountain, which celebrates this belief or this legend or whatever that all the witches in Russia come to Bear Mountain October 31st and they revel all night, and as the dawn comes they disappear, and the music very eloquently portrays that. Now, it's interesting, here's a surprise maybe, in early American history, Halloween was not practiced. It was not widely observed until the 20th century. It was introduced by the Irish Catholic immigrants. They brought these ideas from Ireland. In Ireland, by the way, it's the only country in the world where Halloween is a national holiday. Now, in the Middle Ages, the Catholic Church in Europe, in an attempt to oppose paganism that was involved in Samhain, they made, in order to try to offset that, the Catholic Church set up November 1st as All Saints Day, a day commemorating all the saints of the church. And the first evidence of November 1st as the date of church celebration occurred during the reign of Pope Gregory III, but it was in 837 that Pope Gregory IV, ordered its general observance. November 2nd, the next day, was later designated as All Souls Day. You had All Saints Day and then you had All Souls Day, which eventually became a special day to pray for the dead. Now, that leads to another concept that emerges here. In the late 1800s, it was customary for English Catholics to assemble at midnight on Halloween to pray for the souls of departed friends. On November 2nd, in Belgium, people ate special soul cakes, All Souls cakes, because supposedly the more cakes you ate on this night, the more souls you could save from purgatory. In Sicily, on All Souls Day, cakes with images of skulls and skeletons were eaten. In France, on All Souls Day, it was dedicated to prayers for the dead who were not yet glorified. In earlier times, the people took special bread called souls to cemeteries, placing on the graves. People ate these soul cakes because they thought it to be a powerful antidote against any flames of purgatory that might be invoked on the returning ghosts. At dusk, the festival changed from All Saints' Day to All Souls' Eve. Lighted candles were placed on the graves and in the windows to guide the dead back home. These are all, obviously, ideas that emerged in those ancient times that get reflected by various things in Halloween. But we begin to understand, as we look at this carefully, how the ancient practices of the ancient Celts get commingled with the Catholic concept of purgatory. And a Catholic concept of purgatory, of course, is related to the Druid belief that the sinful souls of those who died during the year had been relegated to the bodies of animals. Through gifts and sacrifices, their sins could be expiated and their souls freed from to claim their heavenly reward. And Samhain, which is the name of the festival, also some scholars believe was also the name of the Lord of Death among the Celts, he judged the souls, presumably, and decreed in what form of their existence was to continue, whether in the body of a human being or an animal and so forth. Now, in medieval England, the Halloween festival became known as All Hallows' Eve, hence the name that derives later. And since it was associated with those in purgatory, the feast was abolished by the Church of England after the Reformation, but has since been revived in the Anglo-Catholic churches. And gradually, Halloween, of course, introduced to this country by the Irish immigrants in the late 1800s, it gradually became a secular observance, broadly held, and many practices developed. Now, one of these, of course, that you see associated with this holiday is the jack-o'-lantern. It's interesting how many different ideas try to track that back. It seems that the carved pumpkin may have originated from the witch's use of a skull with a candle inside, which illuminated their coven meetings. That's probably where it had a beginning. However, you do encounter some strange legends among the Irish. If you do some research in this area, you'll encounter the legend of Irish Jack. He was presumably a stingy drunk named Jack who tricked the devil into climbing a tree for an apple, but then cut a sign of the cross in the trunk of the tree, preventing the devil from coming down. Jack forced the devil to swear that he would never come back after Jack's soul, and the devil reluctantly agreed. And when Jack eventually died, he was turned away from the gates of heaven because of his life of drunkenness and sinfulness and selfishness, and he then went to the devil, who also rejected him because he was keeping his promise. So as Jack was leaving hell, and it seems that he was happened to be eating a turnip at the time, the devil threw a live coal at him. And condemned to wander the earth, rejected from both above and below, Jack put the coal inside the turnip, making a jack-o'-lantern. And eventually pumpkins, especially in America, replaced the turnip. And that's one of the legends, Irish legends, that they tell the kids lying behind what we call a jack-o'-lantern. But it's a colorful, strange thing. But let's move on with the trick-or-treat and costumes. We sort of associate that with the celebration of Halloween. Among the ancient Druids, the ghosts that were thought to throng about the houses of the living were greeted with a banquet-laden table. At the end of the feast, the masked and costumed villagers, representing the souls of the dead, paraded to the outskirts of the town, leading the ghosts away. Druid ceremonial participants also wore animal heads and skins to acquire the strength of that particular animal, typical animistic belief. Masks and costumes were employed in traditional shamanism and other forms of animism to change the personality of the wearer to allow communication with the spirit world. Now, on the one hand, we smile at these ancient ideas, and yet I'm going to suggest before we're through that there is some serious, serious dangers in these games. Now, immigrants to the United States, particularly among the Irish, introduced Halloween customs, and that became popular in the late 19th century. Traditional mischief-making on this occasion was eventually replaced by the familiar small children going from house to house, usually in costume, calling for trick-or-treat. Going from door to door to seek treats may trail back to this Druid practice of begging material for the great bonfires. And to make the bonfires, the concept they had to solicit the materials. And also, this may also relate to the Catholic concept of purgatory and the custom in certain countries of begging for soul cakes regarding all that. Now, the trick part of trick-or-treats of Halloween appears to be derived from the idea that the ghosts or witches created mischief on the living if they did not provide the treats. Now, it became very obvious to some of the people that had a sense of humor that this could all be camouflaged by playing practical jokes on that could be then blamed on the ghosts or witches, if you will. So that obviously, you can fill in the blanks. Some other aspects of Halloween that are probably not as obvious, the predominance of fruits and nuts is typically associated with this particular holiday. Three of the sacred fruits of the Celts were acorns, apples, and nuts. Hazelnuts particularly. Acorns were sacred, associated with the oak. In fact, the word druid means priest of the oak cult. And the hazelnut was also associated with one of their gods. In ancient Rome, by the way, cider at this time of year was drawn, and the Romans bobbed for apples. Dunking for apples became an aspect of romance divination for trying to discover your future mate. In Scotland, young people assembled for diverse games to ascertain which of them would marry during the year and in what order the marriages would occur. There's all kinds, I'll spare you a rundown of all the details, but there's all kinds of usually apple-related divination among young girls. They believed that if you did an apple a certain way in front of the mirror on that night, that an apparition of your future mate would appear behind you in the mirror kind of thing. All these superstitions, they're all sort of woven into October 31st, etc. I find it rather interesting that as you explore all these pagan traditions that surround this particular holiday, it fascinates me that since 1965, UNICEF, an agency of the United Nations, has adopted Halloween as an opportunity to collect money for the United Nations Children's Fund. I haven't seen it in some of my recent years, but I gather there are from time to time people go house to house, instead of trick-or-treating, they'll be collecting money for UNICEF. Sounds like a very appropriate thing, but in my mind, it's unusually appropriate for this ungodly United Nations to exploit this pagan holiday. Somehow that seems very strangely appropriate. I might mention, by the way, in my recent trips to Europe, I was rather startled to discover a practice that seems to be widely promoted among the hotels. When I checked into one of the hotels, in fact, this happened twice in two different countries on that same trip, I check into the hotel, and my materials, when I checked in, pointed out that $1 will be added per day to my room bill as a voluntary contribution to the United Nations Children's Fund. I was free to indicate on checkout that I objected to that, and they'd be glad to remove it. But it took an overt action on my part, which I did take, of course. I have no objection to children, but I've got gigantic objections to the United Nations or any government meddling in this area. But in any case, they gave you little cards and things. But the point is they have managed somehow to promote this idea that in the billing, they assume that unless you object, you volunteer to add a buck to your bill for this fund, which I found rather provocative. Now, as we proceed down this path of exploring this strange holiday, I can't resist pointing out the bizarre possibility that one of our planets is partly to blame for all of this, in a sense. As you study these ancient cultures, and not just the Celts, but virtually all the ancient cultures, you discover something very strange. They all worshipped the planet Mars. And we sort of take that for granted. We see it in the folklore, that these cultures worshipped the hosts of heaven and so forth. The name for Mars in the Bible is Baal. It's one of the names, one of several names for the planet Mars. There's actually about 360 names in the Bible that allude in one way or another to the planet Mars. You look at that and you sort of shrug it off as ancient superstition, and yet you stop and realize that these cultures were terrified of the planet Mars. Mars became synonymous with war. We use that same term even today. We speak of the martial arts and so forth. It's in our vocabulary. Now, you and I think, would regard ourselves as a fairly sophisticated culture as far as space is concerned, as far as astronomy is concerned. And I would imagine there's not many of us in this room that could go outside and point to the planet Mars if our life depended on it. And yet these ancient cultures were terrified by the planet Mars. Why? Why would they care? And one possibility is that the planet Mars interfered in their lives. It turns out as you start studying ancient calendars, you discover some strange things. You discover that all the ancient calendars, some 14 of them that I've been able to track down, all were built around 360-day years and 30-day months. And you say, well, that's a good approximation, except they all were that way for many centuries until about 701 B.C. In 701 B.C., a large number of them changed. They changed their calendar. The Romans added a few days. The Hebrews added a month on some very weird formula, roughly once every 3 years, but it's not that simple. But all the calendars get mucked around. Rabbinical literature ponders, why did he pick that particular peculiar formula? What they don't explain, it's a mystery, is why did he have to change anything at all? Why did the Romans and the Chaldeans and the Israelis and others modify their calendar in 71 B.C.? Now, it turns out there are some theories about this that sound at first very strange. And that is that the discovery in more recent years, as we refine our understanding of orbits, especially with all the satellite technology of in the recent decades, they recognize very quickly that orbits can resonate just like sound waves do with tuning forks, or just like radio waves do with a tuned radio circuit. That orbits themselves interact with each other and thus have a tendency towards resonance. And the speculation, is that the Earth was on a 360-day orbit, Mars was on a 720-day orbit, it was in a 2-to-1 resonance with planet Earth. It turns out in these models, Saturn and some of the other planets are also factors here. But to keep it simple for this discussion, they have modeled this theory, just a theory, and it turns out that would the model implies that Mars would have a near pass-by with the orbit of the Earth every 108 years at various times. Each time the near pass-by took place, there would be an energy transfer from one to the other that would adjust these things. And finally, in 71 B.C., in one of these near pass-bys, the energy transfers were such as to stabilize them where they are today. The Earth has a 365-and-a-quarter-day, nominally, orbit, and Mars is now 687. And the energy transfers, the details are amazingly they modeled with great precision. Now, what makes this provocative, one reason it comes up, is if their model is correct, it implies that Mars passed near the Earth on a predictable basis. The degree to which it would pass may not have been predicted. That requires a lot of precision. But the fact that every 108 years there was a possibility, if Saturn was in a particular 90-degree relationship in these orbits, then Mars would pass very, very closely. And it turns out, as you lay this all out, it coincides with a whole series of catastrophes in the ancient past, recorded in a variety of ways. Now, I won't take the time tonight to go through all that. We have published a briefing package called The Mysteries of the Planet Mars that attempts to go into this in more detail. Now, as you explore these things, we, of course, got interested in this partly because it impacts the possibilities that might surround the long day of Joshua, plus other issues. And so we've talked about this in the past. But as you explore this and begin to regard it as rather fanciful, it's rather interesting to discover that these theories, colorful though they are and embellished in very elegant mathematics, seem to be corroborated by a guy by the name of Jonathan Swift. Now, Jonathan Swift was a Irish satirist. His intent was to write very bitter satire on the government in London. The Irish did not have a warm feeling for England, and Jonathan Swift wrote this fantasy as a mechanism to poke fun at or to satirize the situation in London at the time. And he wrote his stories about Gulliver's travels, in which Gulliver makes a number of these, encounters a number of these strange places, and in Swift's dealing with this, he uses it to poke at the problems in those days. But the point is that in one of these, in his third voyage, Gulliver encounters a place called Laputa. Not Lilliput, that's the little people, that's the first voyage that most people are familiar with. But unless you've been through Gulliver's travels, the whole thing, you know, there are some other voyages. Anyway, in Laputa, the astronomers in Laputa brag that they know about the two moons of Mars, and the astronomers in London don't. Now, to give you a little background here, Galileo did his things with a telescope in about 1610. And then Herschel, in subsequent years, discovered a number of the planets and made astronomical history over in the later 1700s. It wasn't until 1877, not the 1700s, 1877, that Asaph Hall, using a brand new telescope at the time in the United States Naval Observatory, shocked the astronomical world by discovering that Mars had two moons. Some of the other moons had been well discovered by then, but everybody knew in those days that Mars was noticeably absent any moons, except Asaph Hall and the new telescope discovered it had two moons. Now, the reason they're so hard to find is they're very small, like 8 miles across. That's pretty small. And they're almost black. They have a reflectivity of less than 3%. But with this telescope and the improved optics and all of that, he discovered the two moons of Mars, made astronomical history by announcing this. Now, what's rather provocative is that, incidentally, one of these rotates around Mars slightly slower than the surface speed, which means it appears to go slightly backwards, the only object in our solar system that does that. In Jonathan Swift's description of all of this, he describes their orbits and all that with a surprising degree of accuracy. It's not precise, it's off 10-20%. But still, that's startling, including the retrograde motion. So the point is, what does this got to do with anything? Well, it turns out that Asaph Hall discovered the two moons of Mars in 1877. Jonathan Swift published Gulliver's Travels in 1726, 151 years earlier. And the problem is that the only way you could see the two moons of Mars would be if Mars passed close enough that you could see it with an eyewitness, as an eyewitness. And so the big conjecture among scholars is, how did Jonathan Swift put that in Gulliver's Travels? One of the theories advanced by one writer is it was a lucky guess, which I think most of us would dismiss as not too plausible. Did Jonathan Swift really know about two moons of Mars? Probably not. But the conjecture, and there's some reason to believe that he had access to some Chinese drawings. He apparently had access to ideas that he probably thought were just legends, but he drew upon those to embroider his fantasy, his satire, not realizing that those sketches and notes that he apparently had access to were actually notes from an eyewitness account of one of the near passbys of Mars, where Mars would have been maybe 70,000-80,000 miles from the Earth on the passby. And so those are all conjectures, but the point is, this may explain why on these near passbys of Mars, it would always pass by either about October 25th or March 22nd. And it's interesting that the Celtic New Year was at the end of that month. And it's interesting that the worship of the planet Mars seems to be associated with many of these practices. The Romans had their New Year in March, and some of the near passbys would be in March. It would depend on some things I won't bother getting into here. The January 1st New Year, we are recognizing, Rome in about 364 B.C. changed it to January, and the European nations at various times in the 16th, 17th century changed it to January. So the January 1st New Year, as we know it, was a later arrangement. But as we watch this then, as we look at all this, we begin to understand our biblical expressions where it speaks of them worshiping the hosts of heaven, which are, of course, are detailed mentioned in the Bible as a form of idol worship, a form of demon worship, and the rest of it. And yet, we may wonder where that all starts. It was because there apparently were some reasons for them to be very concerned about Baal or Mars, and that October 31st year-end tradition seems to be tied to that. Getting back to our celebrating Halloween. Obviously, there are a lot of superstitions that surround it. There are many people in many parts of the world that still today believe that particular rituals can have real supernatural effects. There are all kinds of superstitions surrounding this holiday, and these go beyond cataloging. But just a few of them. In New Orleans, the Voodoo Museum offers a special Halloween ritual in which people may see true voodoo rites. In Salem, Massachusetts, a Halloween festival occurs from October 13th to the 31st and also includes a psychic fair. As you start going on and on about this, there are many, many Christians that get really concerned. And I can't resist sharing with you one incident that occurred that Pat Matriciana, he's the head of Jeremiah Films and did these very, very well-done videos on various pagan customs and so forth. Pat was on a talk show, and he was getting set up. It happened that he had access to a earpiece that was connected to the instructions. And due to some unknown crosstalk between the channels, he could, by having it turned up way high, he heard the director tell one of the other people, "Let's set this wacko up." This is during a station break kind of thing. So Pat knew he was being set up. And he thought, how? The only way to do this is take, you know, Pat, typically if you know Pat Matriciano, the thing to do is take the offense. So when they came back live, he threw out this one-liner. For a Christian to celebrate Halloween is like asking a Holocaust survivor to celebrate Hitler's birthday. Well, he was on his way, you know. But it's an interesting problem because we, as Christians, should have some real problems with all of this on the one hand, and the other hand, it's a difficult thing as to where do you really draw the line? What do you really do to not, on the one hand, appear like some kind of wacko, on the other hand, deal with this thing very directly? Now, let's go on a little bit further and talk about some of the dangers.
Okay, I hate to cut him off at such a crucial time, and if you want to, that is Chuck Missler that we've been listening to. Chuck Missler, you can go to his website, which is K, the letter K, house.org, khouse.org, and he's got some free audio there through the 6640 radio program, but you can also download a lot of MP3s all over the net. Just Google Chuck Missler, you will find all kinds of information that he has available. I will put a link to that specific talk on my website, which is nowheretorun.podomatic.com, where I'm going to try to reference all the stuff that we've been showing you today. nowheretorun.podomatic.com. I've also been thinking that I might do kind of a midweek podcast where I just send out a particular bit of audio that I think is interesting or something like that, that would just be that audio. And if you want to receive that, you can get on the podcast. You can either go to nowheretorun.podomatic.com or go to iTunes or any of the other podcast feeds and join the podcast to be able to receive that directly on your iPod. But of course, you can download it or any of the archives from the website as well without joining the podcast. Okay, so you can email me your hate mail and things of that nature at chris@conspiracyclose.com. That is chris@conspiracyclose.com. You can also write to me at P.O. Box 1437, Gallatin, Tennessee, G-A-L-L-A-T-I-N, Gallatin, Tennessee, 37066. Thanks for your time. I've got some good shows planned next week, and also continue to support this show by your prayers. That is how you support this show, and I certainly appreciate them, and I just want you to know that there's no way I could do anything without them, so I appreciate it very much. So you've been listening to Revere Radio. That is revereradio.net, 24 hours a day live stream original programming. Okay, that's it. Thanks for everything. I'll see you guys next week.